The Cultured Meat Symposium is back in San Francisco on October 28th and 29th, 2022. This year, the theme of the event is creativity and commerce. Learn more and register at www.cms2022.com. Thanks for joining us on the Future Food Show. On this episode, we're delighted to have Michelle Simon. As a public health attorney, food policy expert, author, and thought leader, Michelle uses her passionate and fearless voice to advocate for a better food system through her writing, media appearances, and consulting. Michelle's extensive writings on the politics of food and alcohol led to the publication of her first book in 2006, Appetite for Profit: How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. NYU professor Marion Nestle described it as brilliant. Michelle founded the Plant-Based Foods Association in 2016. As executive director of the nation's only membership association to promote the interests of plant-based food companies, she grew the organization to over 300 members and led a team of policy and retail experts. Her leadership and strategic efforts enabled the Plant-Based Foods Association to fight the powerful meat and dairy lobbies while forging new marketplace opportunities for the industry. Michelle currently runs her own strategy consulting business, where she offers advice on policy, media relations, investing, and coaching for women. Michelle Simon is admitted to practice law in California, has a master's degree in public health from Yale University, and received her law degree from the University of California, Hastings College of Law. We cover a lot of diverse topics, and I'll be the first to admit that it was very interesting to understand certain viewpoints as it comes to reducing animals in the food system, restaurants offering vegan options and whether that's a good thing, and taking a closer look at reporting that's out there in the industry now. Let's jump right in. Welcome to the Cultured Meat Future Food Show. We're excited to have Michelle Simon as the guest for today's episode. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Michelle, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, by training, I am a public health lawyer, which simply means I have both a public health degree and a law degree. And I've really made a career out of shining a light on the politics of food. And so starting way back in the late 1990s, I discovered vegetarian and then vegan diets and was really kind of blown away at all of the ways that eating a vegan diet really impacts not just our health, but, you know, animal welfare and of course the environment. And so it was a real awakening for me. And this was post graduate school, so I didn't learn anything about that in school. So I just sort of followed this path of really wanting to dig more deeply into that and understand it through a policy and political lens. And there was no one really at the time, very few people at the time were really writing about these issues. And I started following in the path of Marion Nestle, who was writing a lot about the politics of food from various angles. And so really just kind of pursued that for a number of years, broadening my horizons from writing about the meat and dairy industries to biotechnology, Monsanto, fast food, you know, McDonald's, the problems around marketing to children. I really spent my career all around the politics of food and shining a light on corporate tactics, particularly public relations and lobbying tactics that undermine public health. So again, like through that lens of wanting to make a food system that provides healthy food for anyone who wants it, and that obviously creates a planet that we can all sustainably live on. And so I would say, you know, probably 90% of my work can be described as unpacking and articulating how food corporations distort the marketplace of ideas and the information that we have access to in order to make good choices about how we produce food and what we eat.
Great. And I want to kind of go back to, you know, being vegetarian or vegan in the 90s. And when I talk to a lot of people and they mention the vegan, or I should say plant-based options back then, from a, I guess, CPG standpoint, there weren't too many options. And I kind of want to preface by saying, like, now I'm, you know, as someone who's primarily plant-based myself, I don't think that's a problem at all, because there's so many wonderful ways to kind of eat, even if there are no packaged foods. But I want to kind of ask the question, what was it like being a vegan or vegetarian back in the early 90s from a standpoint of like products that were available?
Yeah, I'm happy to provide that, you know, sort of, oh, back in my day perspective. I mean, I definitely remember the sad days of, like, you know, having to reach into this vat of water that had floating tofu in it. And, you know, we've come a long way from that, and the sort of, you know, really unflavored, chalky soy milks. And I mean, we've certainly are now light years away from that. And that is really due to a lot of the advocacy work by people to, you know, kind of raise the alarm bell about the problem of animal agriculture and, you know, eating too many meat and dairy products, and then the marketplace really responding to that need to provide really great tasting alternatives. And so, yeah, I think we should really stop and celebrate how far we've come in a relatively short period of time to offer consumers, you know, whether it's through their local restaurants or their local supermarket, so many wonderful options, in addition to, of course, the real food that we need to be, everyone probably needs to be eating more of, fresh fruits and vegetables. But, you know, it is nice to live in a time when it's easy to get a wide variety of plant-based alternatives as well.
So you mentioned corporate tactics, and I'd love to get into this a little bit in terms of kind of what this means and maybe how we can look at it from a different lens. Can you give us a broad overview of kind of what you mean by corporate tactics, especially as it relates to, I guess, food companies?
Sure. Well, you know, it shouldn't come as a surprise, but sometimes I'm often amazed at how naive people can be when it comes to really understanding how most corporations operate. You know, as my mentor Mary Nessel likes to say, they are not social service operations, right? Food companies really exist to sell product. And unfortunately, sometimes they go to such lengths to, you know, boost up their bottom line, they will engage in a number of underhanded tactics. So that can be anything from, you know, spinning their, say, let's just take an example like McDonald's, right? Everyone's favorite punching bag when it comes to junk food in America. And so, you know, one of the tactics I wrote about in my book was how McDonald's pretended, you know, to become a salad company, right? Because particularly in the early 2000s, there was a lot of criticism, rightly so, leveled against companies like McDonald's for marketing, peddling a lot of junk food. And in response, these companies, you know, had to respond somehow. And so they started putting salads on the menu, right? To sort of make lawmakers and critics like me kind of, you know, placate us and say, you know, we've got this, you know, now we're putting salads on the menu, so everything's fine. Well, you know, they're still selling the Big Macs and the French fries and the, you know, buckets of soda, just like before. And, you know, what I found is within maybe 6 months to a year, those salads that they made a big deal about quietly went away, right? Because let's be honest, most people aren't going to McDonald's for the salad, right? They're going for the cheeseburger and fries. So it's just, you know, the use of public relations and sort of spinning tales about reputation is a time-honored tactic that many corporations, you know, engage in. Another one is lobbying, right? So, I mean, we know that corporations in this country especially have tremendous power in the halls of Congress and in state legislatures and locally, and wherever there's government, there's a corporate lobbyist to do its bidding. And, you know, most of the time, those lobbying tactics and the positions that companies are, you know, trying to influence on lawmakers are not for the public's good, right? They're in there lobbying for corporate interests. And so, you know, it's just really important to understand that corporations can really engage in quite underhanded tactics in a variety of ways. And, you know, those tactics aren't, you know, they cut across the board, right? No matter really what the company is selling. And so, you know, I want people to understand that, you know, sometimes even, you know, your favorite plant-based brand could be engaging in some of these tactics. Not all of them are, you know, we certainly have a lot of wonderful companies. But just to give you an example of a company that I recently found out is engaging in some questionable labor practices. So, you know, Amy's Kitchen is a well-known organic vegetarian, not vegan, but does make a lot of vegan offerings, but they are vegetarian and organic. So lots of people love Amy's, right? They've been around for a long time. They're even still independently owned. And yet it just came out in the media recently that there are a number of complaints coming from workers from the Amy's manufacturing plant who are being injured and generally feeling taxed, overstressed from overwork. And, you know, we don't have all the details yet. I don't want to just put, you know, slam the company completely, but I'm just raising that as a really great example of a company that I thought was still one of the good ones. And yet even they, you know, are pressed with pressures in the marketplace. And unfortunately, people can get hurt when, you know, companies don't do the right thing. And in this case, it's, you know, maybe not a tactic per se, but it is an example of pressure being brought to bear. And, you know, they are engaging in certain PR tactics in the response to these workers who are speaking out. So, you know, it can happen with any company.
Do you know if that, I guess, manufacturing plant is US based?
It is. It's in Northern California.
It is. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely interesting. And I kind of, for the way I'm approaching kind of this, and let's use that specific issue as an example, I guess on the PR side of things and, you know, quote unquote, damage control, I kind of do come from that background. So I do understand that side of things. But I guess on the safety and I guess OSHA standpoint, definitely something I don't have any experience with. But wouldn't you say that, you know, from, well, I guess I was going to say, wouldn't you say that a lot of companies might be dealing with something like that? But I guess it's more of a management issue where are they taking care of it the right way? And again, we don't know all the details, but, you know, it could be a management issue where they're not taking care of it the right way, which is saddening.
Yeah, we don't know. I can't. I mean, we just all we really know is the media accounts so far.
Going back to kind of broader fast food, or I guess these multinational brands, you mentioned McDonald's, and I agree with the statement that you said that everyone likes to use it as their punching bag. But I want to bring up McDonald's and I want to bring up KFC, because these are two brands that have oftentimes been kind of the target of animal welfare concerns. And now they're starting to release, in limited quantities, plant-based offerings. Mm-hmm. And so it's been interesting to kind of see those who are, for example, protesting outside of a KFC are now promoting it on social media. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, let's just start there. I mean, I do find it fascinating, and you said it exactly right, that, you know, certain vegan activists that, and I, you know, count myself among them, who used to protest outside of Burger King or KFC are now celebrating. And I am not celebrating these fast food companies that are essentially engaging in greenwashing. And sometimes I like to call it plant washing. And while I certainly understand, I mean, just like we were speaking of earlier, you know, the desire to celebrate how far we've come. And, you know, it certainly is, you know, a sign of mainstreaming of these options. I don't want to say it has no meaning to be able to walk into a KFC or McDonald's and find a plant-based option. However, I do think we should be, not so quick to celebrate for several reasons. First of all, the companies are still selling a lot of meat right? It's not as if, let's just take KFC as an example, even for the limited time, right, that they are selling the Beyond Meat version of the chicken nuggets or whatever the product is. It's not as if they're stopping the sale of like animal chicken for that period of time, right? That's never going to happen. KFC is in the business of selling chicken, right? So that's number one, right? The chicken is still being sold. and then if you look at it from a displacement argument, right, which some people want to think, well, now that KFC is selling Beyond Meat chicken, you know, somehow magically those consumers that walk into KFC are not going to order the animal chicken, they're going to order the Beyond Meat chicken. To which I say, well, that would be fantastic if we knew that was actually happening. But we have literally zero evidence to support that idea, even as like a logical proposition. I don't quite understand the logic, because the average person walking into KFC is going for the animal chicken, right? There is really nothing to get that regular consumer of KFC to opt for the Beyond Meat. And I haven't looked at the pricing, but I'm guessing, as is usually the case, the plant-based option is even more expensive. So there's no way in hell the average KFC goer is opting for the more expensive plant-based option, right? So, you know, what that all leads me to is a lot of greenwashing going on, right? This assumption that, oh, this is good news because somehow fewer animals are going to be killed. Well, there's no evidence of that, you know. And so what we have instead is a celebration of this company that is still engaging in horrific, you know, behavior when it comes to not just animal welfare, but labor. I mean, I could go on and on about the reputation that KFC has with how it sources its chicken. I mean, the animal welfare groups know full well what I'm talking about. So to see them, you know, then celebrating the entry of plant-based options into fast food, to me, is it's a slap in the face to labor groups, to, you know, anyone who really cares more broadly about how these companies are operating. And it makes me extremely heartbroken to see this.
There's two things that come to mind. One of them is the IKEA plant-based hot dog at the cafe. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but I think maybe over the last year or so, IKEA released a plant-based option that is, you know, very similar to their hot dog product. And their hot dog is an animal-based hot dog product, but they have like a veggie dog that's vegan, and it's actually priced cheaper than the hot dog. And I would really love to see what kind of metrics they have. I don't know if they share the metrics, but really kind of like to see what kind of metrics they have to see if sales do actually displace. But I think you're right that even in that scenario, I often see from my trips to IKEA, at least, that you definitely have more people ordering the hot dog versus the plant-based. So I definitely don't think it's significant, but that at least is a start. The other thing I'm thinking of is a couple brands that have completely transitioned, and these are CPG brands I'm thinking of, to plant-based, or I guess maybe have announced that they're going to transition to completely plant-based. And so I know that when we're talking about the big fast food chains, this is not very likely, but if there is a brand that says, hey, you know what, this climate thing is serious, animal welfare is a big concern, we're going to go completely plant-based, surely I think that is a sign of good times. Would you agree?
Well, you know, I'd have 100 questions about it, right? So, you know, I think, you know, those of us who've been so in and around the food movement and study food systems and really connect the dots among a number of issues, not just, you know, the sort of patty that's in the bun, right? I mean, it's a very reductionist way of thinking about food. And so Yeah, in theory, like if McDonald's were to announce, oh, we're, I don't know, going vegan, I suppose you could say, well, that's better. But again, I'd have a lot of questions, right? Because it's not about just that one particular thing they're doing, right? I mean, McDonald's holds sway over entire food chains. And, you know, again, there's labor issues. And I'm not saying that it would be a bad thing or we shouldn't want McDonald's to go vegan or whatever, like, but that's not really what's going to happen anyway. So I'm not even sure why it's worth the conversation. Really, what these companies are doing is sort of hedging their bets. And, you know, there's something in the restaurant world called the veto vote, right? So I wrote about this in my book. And it's this concept that you don't want, let's say, a family of five to not go to your restaurant because of the one, you know, vegetarian teenager in the family, right? And so in order to avoid that veto vote, they're going to put some kind of vegetarian option on the menu to ensure that the other four people of the family eat there, which is why, you know, I could even make the argument that by, you know, promoting a vegetarian option in fast food, you're actually bringing in more business for, you know, the meat selling to happen in that fast food place. And it's just much more complicated than boiling it down to like, okay, you know, what's the one thing on the menu that we want to cheer for?
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting thing to think about. And you're right. I mean, with even the examples I'm thinking of, there are 100 questions at least. So, so I think this is an interesting time to segue into cell cultured meat technology. And maybe generally I can just straight up ask, you know, what are your thoughts on cell cultured meat technology or lab grown meat?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we were speaking of how corporations like to engage in PR, and, you know, I have a pretty good, what I like to refer to as a BS detector. And, you know, my impression so far is there's a lot of PR going on in that sector. And, you know, I'm not an expert in the science, so I'm not going to opine on, you know, whether the science is ready for prime time, except to say I'm certainly reading, you know, the critiques like the one by Joe Fassler in The Counter. And I was happy that you had him on to, you know, talk about that scientific critique and questions that are being raised. And, you know, to me, that goes hand in hand with the impression I have, which is it's a lot of PR, right? And so there are so many questions swirling around the commercial viability. And yet there seems to be this like way too early, massive cheerleading celebration going on as if, you know, this is all inevitable. And of course, this, you know, technology is on its way to sort of displacing meat forever. I mean, you know, the predictions, and it's just crazy to me. Like, you know, where is the critical thinking skills and where's the questioning? So that's why, you know, I'm happy to have reporters like Joe Fassler being, you know, digging into it. So that's the kind of on the science side. But, you know, where I go to more is the consumer side, right? So just like we were just raising questions around, okay, so Beyond Meats and KFC, is that really saving any animals? Oh, I have the same questions around this technology, right? And I know all the arguments about, well, you know, this technology is going to replicate meat exactly, which I think is highly questionable in and of itself. But, you know, let's say it does at least, you know, somehow simulate the taste of regular meat and supposedly better than plant-based can. I understand the theory behind that. But, okay, what is the consumer demand for this? What is, you know, what is the attraction to a consumer on a product like this? I'm really having a lot of trouble wrapping my head around how this magical transition is supposed to take place, right? What I keep hearing is, well, as long as it tastes is good. And, you know, we get to price parity, price parity. People talk about that like, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world to get to. And as if once we do, if we ever do, or if the industry ever does, there's some automatic switch that gets flipped that will, you know, magically make every single consumer stop buying regular animal meat and start buying this biotech stuff. And I just don't understand. Like, maybe you can help me, because I know you talk to a lot of people in this sector. Where I like, it just feels like there's no sort of, I don't see the path is the right word. I don't see the path from, okay, we got this stuff in the lab, and we've, even if they can figure out how to commercialize it, which is highly questionable, then explain to me how, what it looks like, you know, in the marketplace, and why, what is the value proposition to the consumer? And I honestly have not, I don't think I've seen anyone explain that. If you have, I would love to hear it.
I would say that the broader industry, those that are really pushing for this technology, they are highly optimistic. And there is this idea that something drastic will happen over the next decade that will make a major shift in the food system. And I think one reason for that is there was an article published, or I guess a report by RethinkX, that they said something along the lines of, by the year 2030, our consumption of meat will be reduced like significantly. And I think it was over 50%. And I don't have any of those numbers in front of me. And that actually, that report came in before the pandemic. And then once the pandemic happened, you see these major changes in lifestyle, maybe not necessarily in meat consumption, but major changes in lifestyle happen overnight. So I think the optimist in me and maybe some of the other folks in the industry might believe that there is a path that will get us to a point where we will be significantly reducing traditional animal agriculture and consumption there. So I think that's one aspect of it. I think that.
But hold on. I mean, can I pause
you
there?
No, please,
so
please.
We can discuss each one. Okay.
Right.
I didn't actually get the path. All I heard was some random bunch of people who know next to nothing, I'm guessing, about how food systems work and the politics of food, are predicting a reduction in meat consumption based on what exactly? Are they saying because we won't be able to, you know, produce as many animals, or because this technology is going to displace? Like, I missed it. like predictions don't do anything. Like, there has to be some logic. And this 10-year thing, by the way, like, I mean, I'm so tired of hearing this 10-year timeframe. It's always 10 years away, whatever it is. So, I mean, if I miss something, please explain to me, because predicting does not tell me logic, you know?
I agree with you. I don't know. I don't have the specific elements that they discussed in the report. I know when the report came out, I did skim through it. But I think, you know, on my side, I'm optimistic, but I also want to be realistic. Do I think that's going to happen? I mean, I don't know. If you kind of gave me a couple, for example, metrics that this is leading in towards that direction, I would be skeptical of that myself. But I do believe that there's this kind of sense that even outside of like the science of things, outside of the production levels, we will see this kind of like radical change in the way people are consuming. Now, I think that is also fueled by the impossibles and the beyonds out there. But I would say that there is no clear path. And maybe that article does define it at least somewhat more of a clear path, but I don't believe there is a clear path.
Right. And I mean, and that's kind of why I was pushing on that, because I see a lot of these reports too, right? And sometimes they're fueled by investors. Like there was one paid for by the investor company Blue Horizons, right? They teamed up with Boston Consulting Group, maybe saw that one. Same thing, these wild predictions. And I'm looking like, where are they getting this from? Like, I want to understand, you know, I don't want to, I mean, I'm fact oriented, you know, and I don't get it. Like, where, you know, it's wishful thinking is putting it mildly. I would say fantasy is more of the right word. And when there's an investor behind it, I just automatically dismiss it because they have a vested interest in making these wild predictions, right? So, you know, I just really want the conversation to come back down to earth and say, you know, the other, you know, area that I'm well versed in is meat industry politics. And the meat industry does not give it, does not care. I'll be polite and say the ministry does not care about what the animal rights activists hope and pray for and fantasize about regarding this technology, right? They're going to keep doing their thing. And I know that some of them are investing in it. Again, it's to hedge their bets. It's to have, you know, to diversify all of the corporate things that we know industry engages in. So, you know, I just really want the conversation to have integrity, right? That's what I'm about. Like, let's stop the BS, because it's really hurting the movement, right? So my overarching objection to this fantasy of biotech meat is that it has hijacked an entire movement such that we can no longer even have reasonable conversations about, like, well, wait, is this really going to happen? Is this the best path? Well, what about health? Like, when I started out as a vegan activist, for me, health was number one. Now it's not number one for everyone, I understand. But, you know, I also learned about animals and the environment. Well, what the hell are we doing replicating a disease-causing food? Like, it just blows my mind that so much of the vegan movement has jumped on this biotech bandwagon and forgotten, like, so many of the ideals that the movement was originally built upon, you know? So that's my, you know, one of my bigger picture concerns. The other one is the hyper-capitalistic approach, the investor-driven approach. We already have a food system that has been corporatized, you know, is in the hands of, like, maybe a dozen companies, right? At least when it comes to meat. And, you know, it's like we're just doubling down on this really undemocratic, highly concentrated, highly corporatized, investor-driven, monetized business model that has put us in this mess in the first place. I fundamentally disagree with the idea that every problem that capitalism has created, capitalism can also solve. I can't tell you how fundamentally wrong, misguided, and really twisted that way of thinking is. When there is not an issue, you know, on the planet that has ever been solved with more capitalism, right? No, other than bringing, you know, people more money, no social issue where people are being harmed, where people are being discriminated against. Like, you name your social issue, capitalism has not solved it. It has only made it worse.
So there, I'm loving the direction that this conversation is going. There's so I have a couple points I want to track back to, okay. And I have actually pulled up some key findings from the report. But first,
okay,
I want to ask, and I don't know the answer to this or any particular direction, but what's better? Is it lobbyists pushing in a particular direction or kind of investor interest pushing in a particular interest? Or are those both bad?
I would say that's a false dichotomy, right? So, you know, one of the traps that I see a lot of advocates fall into is they paint the picture of all of, you know, the parade of horribles of animal agriculture as if there's any disagreement about that. I have no disagreement. We know that the current picture of animal agriculture is a horror show, right? And of course, the political lobbying that goes on is awful. But, and I want to say this, but saying that creating a new form of, you know, technology is going to solve any of that. I mean, again, show me the path. Like, what we have here is a fundamental political and economic problem. And the proponents of this technology are taking a market-based approach to what is really a much deeply entrenched problem of animal agriculture, right? And all you have to do is look at other issues to see that a market-based approach, a consumer-based approach, a technology approach, any combination of those three ideas doesn't solve fundamental entrenched problems, particularly in our food system. And the best example is to look at the history of natural and organic foods, right? So, I mean, this whole effort to displace animal meat with either plant-based or cell-based alternatives is not the first to, you know, attempt to displace harmful causing products in the food system, right? So what is organic agriculture about? Of course, it's all about trying to displace conventional agriculture with more sustainable practices. Well, how's that going? I mean, the organic industry has, you know, has its own trade group, has been humming along now, even, you know, increasing its sales, certainly, over the years. But conventional ag has not gone away. Quite the opposite. It's doing very well, right? And so what I'm saying is this idea of just kind of laying on another layer of market-based approaches has been shown to not work and will not work in this instance either. You know, we have evidence of this not working. And so why are we trying it just in a different arena, thinking it's going to be different?
I guess thinking about it, in many ways, it has worked in that people are now paying more for food. And so it at least works for those who are selling.
Yes, of course. Like I said before, capitalism works great for the people who are in it to make money, right? I mean, there's no question that, you know, selling more Beyond Meat works great for Beyond Meat shareholders. And some of them made a lot of money when Beyond Meat went IPO. And of course, stock's gone down. But I'm not saying capitalism doesn't work for anyone. I'm saying it works for a very small number of people who already have a lot of money, and it just gets them more money. What it doesn't do is solve any social problems and help people more generally.
I want to track back to another point about like biotech foods, right? And I guess I'd like to ask you the questions like, aren't biotech foods good? Like, for example, we kind of use biotechnology to produce, I think, rennet for cheese or insulin instead of using animals. So in those senses, maybe there's also other things to unpack, but in those senses, biotech is good, right?
So I think another misperception or another way that my work gets dismissed or my opinions get dismissed is to say that I'm anti-biotech. I get this a lot. Oh, well, you're just anti-biotech, Michelle. You know, it's sort of like in the old days when, you know, certain lobbyists would say to me, well, you're just vegan. That's why you're against meat. It's like, well, okay, but there's reasons for that. It's not that I'm anti, like, just, you know, randomly that I'm anti-biotech. I understand there are certain, you know, legitimate applications of biotechnology. I'm not against all forms of technology. I'm saying when it comes to food, I think we should be particularly careful about it and be thoughtful about it and think, well, is this, you know, an appropriate application? Or more importantly, is this an application, first of all, that the consumer has full transparency on, which has not been the case in the past? I mean, you know, I worked for many years on efforts to get GMO foods labeled, for example. And, you know, what we're seeing now are, you know, what I call companies that can be described as Monsanto 2.0, who are engaging in a whole new set of PR tactics to really not help the consumer understand what these products are made of. But the more important objection I have goes back to, you know, what we've been talking about really all along, which is, are these products really going to deliver on the promise that they're making, which purportedly, as I understand it from their PR, is to displace the animal products, right? So, you know, I'm writing an article right now for Forbes about like questioning the consumer demand for products like cake batter made with genetically engineered whey. I am not aware of one consumer on the planet who has been, you know, walking up and down the supermarket aisle desperately in search of cake batter made with whey, but not from a cow. Are you aware of a consumer who wants that?
I'm laughing a little bit here. but okay, so maybe not cake batter, but definitely protein powder. And
okay, let's talk about protein powder.
The same company has protein powder with animal
free. I'm happy to talk about protein powder because that's in my article too.
Okay.
Okay, let's talk about whey as an ingredient, first of all. Whey is a byproduct of cheese, okay? Whey was not invented as some kind of like magical nutritional ingredient, right? The dairy industry had a lot of whey on its hands because it's a byproduct of cheese making. And Lord knows Americans like their cheese. And so a lot of cheese gets made to feed the American habit. And then the dairy industry always has to find, you know, like any industry has to find, a market for their byproducts. Okay, so it's really important to understand that whey is a byproduct of cheese making. And that's why the main reason it started showing up as this magical, you know, then it was isolated, the proteins isolated, and then it starts showing up in all these sports powders, right? But there's nothing healthy, nothing special, nothing magical about whey from dairy. Okay, it's just a byproduct that the dairy industry very cleverly, you know, teamed up with the sports industry and figured out how to turn it into this stupid whey protein for sports, right? So that's the background for what that product is all about. And now you have Perfect Day coming along and saying, we're going to solve this problem by making a genetically engineered version of whey, turning it into our own protein powder and saying, we've saved the planet. What? I'm sorry. This is insane to me. Completely insane. They haven't done anything to deal with the underlying problem of why whey is on the market in the first place. Furthermore, they are perpetuating this myth that whey is this magical ingredient that is necessary for like recovery after sports or whatever BS marketing whey is used for, right? So what problem are they solving exactly? I just don't understand.
Nutritionally though, and I don't have any, again, numbers in front of me, but nutritionally, I do believe whey does perform higher than like soy protein or pea protein.
It's dairy industry nonsense. And to the contrary, there's plenty of evidence that whey is harmful. There's nothing natural about whey, okay? It's been isolated as a byproduct. So like whatever BS the dairy industry has been able to put out there about whey being superior, I'm not impressed by, right? Show me who funded all those studies, right? I mean, there's actually something called the Gatorade Sports Institute that tells us Gatorade is the best thing for, you know, recovery after exercise, right? So you have to go like a layer deeper and not just believe the surface stuff that we hear.
Right. I think this, and I do want to kind of get to the Rethink article points, but I think this is, it's really kind of, it's hard to kind of filter through that, right? So I guess if there's one takeaway, and maybe we don't figure that out now But if there's one takeaway, I think listeners, I want them to get from this conversation is how do you filter through the bias or the BS? So, I mean, how there's so much going on, so much marketing from all sides. How do you kind of know what's what? I mean, especially because, and I agree with you, just because something is published doesn't mean it's not funded by somebody that is biased or wants to kind of push things in a certain direction. I've definitely seen that myself working in science and mm-hmm. technology. Right. What is the best way to filter through the bias?
Well, don't believe that anything that comes out of a press release, that's for sure. Let's start there. And, you know, unfortunately, we have a situation now where the food business media, the trade publications, but mostly what I call the vegan media is collectively doing a dismal job at asking these sorts of critical questions. Unfortunately, most media outlets are simply, you know, pumping out press releases. They're basically regurgitating press releases from companies in the biotech arena and, you know, all food companies, frankly. So, you know, I don't have a good answer. People always ask me, well, what can we believe? Well, you know, there's just basic common sense. And the we certainly have plenty of good information out there about where good nutrition comes from. It's not from whey and it's not from Beyond Meat. Right? It's from real food. So, I mean, it's to me, it's not really that complicated. I mean, really, human beings thrive on a mostly whole foods, plant-based diet, period. Like, that's kind of all you need to know to go about your daily life when it comes to food. Now, you know, whether you choose to supplement, you know, real food with the occasional Beyond Meat or, you know, cake batter made with GMO whey, like, sure, like, it's not going to harm you. I mean, but just don't think that you're getting superior nutrition by, you know, downing whey protein made genetically engineered and not from a cow. You know, it's just like basic common sense. Like, we should be eating real food if we're talking about nutrition. If we're talking about, like, what to believe in terms of, like, you know, these companies that are promoting biotech to save animal agriculture, well, I don't believe any of them. Because, I mean, mostly what we're seeing right now, most of the messaging that's coming out of these companies, it's not even for consumers, it's for investors, right? So take, for example, the, you know, big press that Upside did both with its rebrand and then more recently with its, you know, shiny new facility in Northern California. That wasn't for the press. That was for investors to get them to invest more money. So I just think if you have these sorts of lenses on, you know, like, take off the rose-colored glasses and put on clear ones and say, oh, why is this company coming out with this press right now? Wait, are they in a funding round? Oh, now I get it, right? So it's just kind of going beneath the surface, thinking like, you know, somebody who's desperate to try and keep the money rolling in, thanks. And also, like, these companies are now that have a lot of money invested and that have product on the market, they're desperate to pump out more products on the market, right? I mean, it really is sadly about making money and not so much about saving the planet or animals. And that's what I want people to understand.
I want to kind of flip the conversation in somewhere totally different for just a second. Okay. Elon Musk and electric cars. Have you thought about that at all? Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I a couple of things. First of all, cars are not food. So I'm never really impressed when, and to me, it's just another sign when, I'm not saying this about you, but I'm saying about people in general who try to use examples from the technology arena, like straight up technology, like cars, and use those as somehow, you know, signs or ways to predict the future regarding food. And, you know, it tells me that these are people who really have not spent their lives deeply entrenched in the food movement and in how food systems operate, and certainly not in the politics of food. So, you know, there's to me no comparison between cars and food. First of all, you buy one car, you know, you keep it for like whatever, 10, 15 years. I mean, it's a very different type of decision than food that you put on your plate to feed your children, that you've grown up with, that has cultural deep meaning. I mean, there's just, they could not be more different. The decision making that goes on around buying a car versus what we feed our children. Okay. So that's the first thing. The other is, you know, we haven't really made the transition to electric vehicles, have we? Because, you know, the oil and gas industries are still very prominent, and we need, that really requires a political solution. I mean, look at what the whole conversation that's going on around climate change right now. I mean, we cannot rely on the markets alone to fix these problems, regardless of the arena. And that's true in, you know, fossil fuels, and it's even more true in food.
Yeah, and I guess I brought it up to, you know, from a marketing, PR, branding standpoint, to move towards something, you know, more sustainable. And I realize as I'm saying that, I've kind of been tricked by the marketing itself, because I believe that electric cars are more sustainable. But I guess to your point, it's actually not proven yet, and we're still reliant on gasoline-powered engines.
Right. Plus, I mean, again, it's, you know, a new form of technology can create new problems too, right? So we know there's all kinds of, I mean, I just think the reliance on technology and the marketplace is never going to be sufficient to shift an entire way of producing and consuming anything. That's my main point.
So we're coming up on time, but there's still a couple things I'd love to chat about. And maybe now is a good time to kind of, you know, read a couple of these key findings from this Rethink X report. And so one of the key findings is that by 2030, demand for cow products will have fallen by 70%. And another key finding is that production volumes of U.S. beef and dairy industries and their suppliers will decline by more than 50% by 2030 and by nearly 90% by 2035. And on their kind of landing page with key findings, it doesn't go into the how, but yeah. I quickly downloaded the report and just to kind of refresh from when I first read it. And it does kind of just talk about all these different solutions, but, you know, kind of opening my eyes to it now, even some of the terminology they use, we can kind of clearly see that there's been influence there. So I guess as we kind of go to this next phase of the conversation, let's talk about influence in the industry. And I know we talked about bias, but you know, if there is a big influence pushing a particular industry, let's say cultured meat industry, in a direction, you know, why is that a good thing? Why is that a bad thing? You know, how do we kind of address that?
When you say influence, I'm not sure I understand the question.
I guess influence from like marketing dollars, backing reports, lobbying, really any type of...
So sort of the ecosystem, you mean, that we're in, that's kind of promoting this technology.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, what comes to mind is I really enjoy talking to Isha Dattar from New Harvest. I don't know if you've probably had Isha on or other folks from New Harvest. Yeah. So, you know, Isha and I don't agree on, you know, the fundamental application of cell-based technology. But, you know, what I appreciate about her is that she does agree that it's probably too soon to really be talking as much as we are about commercialization, right? And so you know, I remember, you know, just a few years ago when it was still being talked about as a scientific endeavor. And, you know, I was skeptical about it, but I was like, okay, you know, they're going to just keep doing what scientists do and, you know, see if that's going to go anywhere. And that's kind of the way New Harvest talks about it. Like, this is still, you know, a laboratory-based field, right? And they're supporting. And I don't really have a big problem with that. Like, okay, you scientists sort of figure it out. The problem I have is, I think, what you're asking about, which is this whole sort of, you know, unbelievable PR push in the media, which, you know, combined with this investor frenzy, and it's hard to kind of know which came first. But certainly when you have, you know, what's now become an over $20 million budgeted organization, such as the Good Food Institute, constantly pumping propaganda out there into the airwaves and, you know, driving investments and putting out very questionable reports that have been, you know, debunked by other scientists. It's like, it does really, I find it extremely troubling. And again, going back to this sort of sucking up a lot of air in the room about this very questionable technology on a number of levels, it causes, it really creates an opportunity cost where we're not talking about more viable solutions. You know, we haven't really talked this whole hour about, well, whatever happened to like addressing the elephant in the room, which is really an extremely powerful meat lobby, right? So, I mean, what we have is this over-reliance that's putting all of our, you know, tofu eggs in one basket of biotechnology, of marketplace solutions. And that is distracting us from the much more fundamental, you know, deeper entrenched problems of our democracy. You know, remember that. I mean, you know, I think it should make everyone completely freaked out that over half the states have passed or are passing laws to undermine democracy. Like, if you care about anything in, you know, society, you should care about. I'm saying, like, that's the kind of thing that is way more important to be focused on, because that's where, you know, the wrong forces are getting more and more control. And it's like, while we're, you know, celebrating Upside's Foods' shiny new facility, democracy is being undermined and the meat industry is right there to, you know, keep doing what it does. And they're happy to have us distracted, you know, with this fantasy idea while they keep doing their thing.
What is, I mean, you mentioned meat lobby, to combat that, or maybe to level out the playing field, don't we need, you know, the plant lobby, or is that, again, totally the wrong approach?
Well, no. And I mean, you know, we haven't talked about this either, but, you know, I created the Plant-Based Foods Association for the purpose of helping to level the playing field. Understand, because I had spent my whole career, you know, understanding, studying how trade groups worked to lobby on the wrong side of the issue, I realized that the plant-based food sector needed to pull together to create a collective voice to lobby for the right side of the issue. So that was the idea that I formed in 2014 and spent, you know, the better part of 2015 by myself getting it off the ground, by pulling together the right leadership that finally agreed with me this was the right thing to do. And we launched in 2016, and I grew the association successfully over 5 years and lobbied, you know, vociferously against the meat and dairy industries over their, you know, stupid attempt to stop almond milk from being labeled almond milk and all of that. So yes, of course we need more of that. We need to create more lobbying entities and to create more power in the halls of Congress and in state legislatures around the country. But, you know, we also have to understand that, you know, an association made up of a couple of hundred member companies, most of whom are startups, is really no match for the powerful meat and dairy lobbies that have been at this for decades. So, you know, it's going to take much more than any one particular lobbying group or, you know, another C4 organization, which I'm seeing formed, and I'm scratching my head thinking, you know, we need a grassroots revolution. And that's really what the vegan movement has been missing all along. So when I hear things like, well, you know, we have to rely on biotechnology because all the education of people that we've been trying for years hasn't worked. Well, education was never going to work. You know, that's the least effective form of behavior change. What we have is a political problem, right? And so we have to create a political solution. And that takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. And that's where I want to see this movement go, not where it is now.
As we come up on time, I want to kind of open it up and ask you if you have any last insights or maybe thoughts that listeners can take away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you, Alex, for allowing me to, you know, get in my soapbox here and for being so open to having this type of conversation. I think it's sorely needed and largely missing. And so I just want to take that opportunity to say, this is exactly what we need to do. You know, we need to create forums where people with different ideas can come together, because, you know, what's happening is you have a very small number of organizations and individuals and, you know, mostly white men. And I've been writing about this too. You have really a very, a clique. And I would even go so far as to say a cult that has formed around these ideas. And what that is doing is locking out any dissenting voices or any even just other strategies, right? And to fix such a massive problem that we all agree is a problem of animal agriculture, we need a diverse set of thinkers and strategists and people to be funded and for their voices to be heard and not to be shut out by a very small number of people who have only one or two ways of thinking. So I am grateful for having this conversation with you, and I hope that it can continue and we can find more ways to have it. So thank you.
Michelle, thank you so much for being on the show. This is your host, Alex, and we look forward to seeing you on our next episode.
This program was produced by H Media. See you soon.